We're all terribly excited about this.
I think we're muted, but we'd be jumping up and down if we
could. All right, here comes Adam. Congressman Schiff, are you here?
Yes, I am. How are you?
Fine. We're so excited to have you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for letting me join. How are y'all doing?
I think I had everybody mute so it wouldn't be cacophonous. So if you guys want to unmute and say hello and then remute, we can do that.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you for being here.
Good evening, Congressman.
Great to
have you.
Thank you.
Hello,
thank you
everybody.
Hello.
Thank you for being here, Congressman.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for reading the book.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to get right to it because we know your time is precious. If you Googled us, you probably already know that we're an online community that's centered around the Balloon Juice blog. We're from all over the country and we're here because we're interested in politics. So you can imagine how thrilled we are to have you. Is it fair to assume, that's what we're assuming, that you're mostly here tonight as an author to talk about the book?
Yes, but you know, you should feel free to ask me questions, go beyond the book if you like.
Well, okay. And we're kind of hoping maybe we can talk more politics at the next one, because it's kind of hard not to when we're trying to figure out how we move the country forward. Anyway, I've asked Kurt Searles to facilitate the conversation tonight. But before I turn it over to Kurt, I'm going to guess that the fellow who started the blog would like to say a word or two. John, are you here? John Cole, are you here?
Sorry, I was muted. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
I have nothing in particular to say. I just wanted to thank you for coming here and spending your time with us, Representative Schiff.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Okay. Well, Kurt, take it away.
Great. Thank you again, Congressman Schiff. I join everyone else in welcoming you and letting you know how much we appreciate you popping into this. Ordinarily, this is where I would give you a long and florid introduction, but you're going to be talking to 150 people who read a 450-page book, so I think they know who you are. So with that, I'm going to have you go right into talking about whatever you want to talk about, and then we'll have a few questions for you.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Well, you know, I'll keep my introduction very brief so that we can get more into talking about what you'd like to talk about. I'll start out with why I wrote the book. On many occasions over the last several years, most often on the House floor, had colleagues who would come up to me and say some version of the same thing, which was, I hope you're writing this down. You better be writing this down. Please tell me you're writing this down. You're in the middle of something quite historic, you need to be recording. You need to be recording this. And I would always give the same answer, which is, when do I possibly have time to write any of this down? And then the pandemic hit, and suddenly, like so much of the country, I was forced into a kind of seclusion, and I figured if I was ever going to write it down, now was the time. And I really wanted to try to do two things that were not incompatible with each other, but two different audiences that I wanted to try to speak to at the same time. One, and most importantly, is I wanted to try to sound the alarm broadly to the country about just how fragile our democracy is and how much at risk it is. And for a whole generation of folks who grew up after World War II, myself very much a part of that generation, we lived in an era in which the freedoms around the world were ever expanding. There were new democracies being born. People experienced greater freedom to associate with whom they would, to express themselves, to practice their faith, to love who they loved. And I think we assumed that this was some inexorable law of nature, that the world was just on an ever-increasing trajectory towards greater freedom, that to paraphrase Martin Luther King, the moral arc of the universe may be long, but it bends towards justice, only to find that it is not at the moment bending towards justice. And indeed, for the last decade, the autocrats have really been on the rise. And as it turns out, there's nothing really immutable about this supposed law of nature. It's something that is only accomplished with struggle, and that struggle wasn't over before our generation came along. So I wanted to sound the alarm very broadly about just how precarious our democracy is at this moment in time. But at the same time, I knew, because I had tried now two impeachment cases, the first 10 years ago involving a federal judge and the second involving the president of the United States, how infrequent impeachments are and how much historic interest they are. You know, when I was working on preparations for the president's impeachment, how much I would have loved to have a blow-by-blow of the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. And a lot has been written about that impeachment, but not in the sense of what it was like really to be there and what the issues really were as opposed to what they might have appeared to be in the articles themselves. And so I felt that, future students and historians would want a resource. I wanted to provide that resource and the depth that would be useful, but also given the rampant gaslighting that's been going on over the last several years and the effectiveness of a lot of that gaslighting, I wanted to set down the historic record. And so that was my desire in writing the book. I like to write. So that part was a labor of love, but I have to say that, I also found certain parts of it quite traumatic to relive. And you may have experienced that as readers, going through this again. And yet, I thought there was value in setting it down in one place in a coherent narrative. I hope it was coherent, because we were living these events in real time and drinking out of this fire hose. And when they were coming at you so fast, it was hard to see how one thing related to another and what the big picture looked like. And I wanted to try to set out in broad strokes what that big picture looks like. So that's why I wrote the book. Really look forward to your feedback and your questions, and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all tonight.
Thank you. That was great. So I had the first question I'm going to throw out is basically a synthesis of a number of questions that were discussed last week. Casey, who's on tonight, made this brilliant observation that, you know, it's a workplace. You guys, the congresspeople and your staff, are working in a workplace. And to some extent, to a large extent, the Republicans have essentially made it a hostile work environment. And, you know, is that, do you think, on purpose? What effect does that have on you and your staff? You know, you could take that only so far. I don't know of any corporate CEO that incited a mob to hang the vice president of marketing, but you see where that comes in. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation. And I think it's really quite accurate. It's not infrequent that people will observe, and I think quite rightly, that in the case of, for example, a Paul Gosar, who, you know, makes a video glorifying the murder of one of his colleagues, or others that are, you know, putting out, virulent anti-Semitic tropes and bile and through their rhetoric encouraging violence against their colleagues. If that were in a private workplace, they would be out of a job. And in terms of what the workplace is like now, I think there is a real sense of foreboding of future violence because we have one of our two major parties that is out there affirmatively pushing a lie about the last election. And along with it, the idea that we can't rely on elections anymore to settle our differences, because any election that you lose is somehow fraudulent and illegitimate. If that idea takes hold, and to some degree within the Republican Party it has, it really paves the way for future violence. And so the workplace does, in that sense, feel quite hostile. And I think you see it reflected in part in the number of people retiring and deciding, okay, I'm just not going to put up with this anymore. I don't need to put up with this. You know, for others of us, you know, it just continues to, notwithstanding its unpleasantness and more than unpleasantness, the danger that comes along with it on the subject of, you know, consistent death threats, it nonetheless seals us with a sense of mission that the country is vulnerable right now, our democracy is vulnerable right now, and we need to stay at our post. But I think that's a very astute observation. It does feel at times like a hostile workplace.
Well, we can credit Casey for that. I've got a question kind of related to that. I'm going to call on Athanase, or whatever name you want me to use.
Athanase or Emily.
Emily, I can pronounce.
Yeah, okay. My question, Congressman Schiff, in your book, you highlight your sort of shock at the increasingly poor behavior of Republicans in Congress. And my question is, what do you attribute this to? Is it just a matter of they're responding to an increasingly polarized base, or are there other factors that you think are coming into play there?
It's a great question. As you know, I keep coming back in the book and in life to something that Robert Caro, the historian, once said in an interview, that power doesn't corrupt as much as it reveals. It doesn't always reveal us for our best, but it says a lot about who we are. And I think in the era of Trump, when you have the promise of power for some, hey, chance to join the cabinet, people that would otherwise never be qualified for a position like that, but now suddenly had a ticket to be at the highest ranks of government, or they were at risk of losing their position in Congress because they might have a challenge from a Trumpist if they weren't in line or they deviated from the president's personal wishes in any way or criticized the president. You got to see what people were made of. And I suspect that they were made of that all along. It's just that the desire for more power or the desire to hold on to power revealed a lot about who they were. And, you know, to give you but two examples, I think power revealed a lot about Liz Cheney, that she is a person of great courage and conviction. And I might have a very different ideology, and I do, than she does. But it turns out there was something more important to her than her position, and that was her country and her beliefs. And she wasn't going to go along with this big lie about the elections, even if it meant losing her position. There was something more important to her than her position and her ambition. And at the same time, when she said she was not going to go along with that, another member of Congress, Elise Stefanik, put up her hand and said, you need someone to tell the big lie. I'll tell the big lie. I'll tell any lie you need me to tell. If I can have her position, I'll tell any lie you want me to tell. And she has, and now she has that job. And, you know, in those two stories, you can tell a lot about those two people and their character. No one was forcing Elise Stefanik to volunteer to put out the big lie. She was more than willing. It was a chance to advance. And this was someone who in the past, in the pre-Trump era, had, you know, portrayed herself as a moderate, someone, you know, very well educated and sophisticated. And so it's purely a matter of ambition. And, you know, I have to say, before the last 5 years, you know, these kind of intangible concepts of power and ambition and what historians would write about it and philosophers, I have to say, I took with a certain grain of salt. But now I really have had a chance to see that so viscerally. You know, one of my takeaways from the impeachment trials is that there's nothing wrong with our Constitution. I don't favor, for example, changing the vote for impeachment to a majority vote, which would turn us into a kind of parliament. The problem isn't in the Constitution, it's really in ourselves. If members of Congress don't live up to their oaths, if they don't give them meaning by looking to ideas of right and wrong and a willingness to accept the truth and the fact there is something that is true and there are things called facts, that we're not all entitled to our own alternate facts, none of it works. And so I have to say, I think the The answer is quite simple and quite terrible, which is it comes down to what people are made of. And all too often, they're made of ambition and driven in part by fear, and that so many of the things they professed to care about didn't matter when compared to the desire to hold office or gain higher office.
That's, you know, we have a follow-up question too. You know, you talked earlier about writing the book and having to relive, you know, the whole process in doing so. So we have a question from Laura that hits at that.
Yeah, thank you for being here and also for your service to the country. Congressman Schiff, I think that you've given all of us a great deal of hope over the last 5 years, even though we were kind of all in this together. I know everyone here truly has appreciated your work. My question after finishing the book just a few nights ago, and thank you for reading it as well. It was lovely to hear as an audiobook. It was really kind of hard. I had to stop a few times because it was that sense of overwhelm of like, oh my gosh, you know, yes, we've all been through this. We've lived through this. It's kind of hard to believe that we lived through all of this. And that sense of the overwhelm. And I wondered if there were parts of the book that were particularly hard to write about because of either that sense of overwhelm or that sense of the fact that you knew this was going to be part of the historical record going forward and you really had to get it right.
I think the part of the book that was the hardest for me to write, the most, you know, difficult to relive, was when Bill Barr first issued his false summary of the Mueller report, when he sent that 4-page summary. And, I was deeply skeptical of whether this summary was an accurate summary of the Mueller report. After all, I reasoned that if the Mueller report was as long as it was reported to be, that is, it was several hundred pages, I was sure that Mueller had his own summary, which begged the question, why would Barr issue a summary that was not his, that was not Mueller's own? And I know also from working in the classified realm that you often write two summaries, one that is classified and one that is unclassified. And I was sure that Mueller's summary, if it wasn't already unclassified, could easily be so. So I was certainly skeptical, and my skepticism grew as we heard rumors and intelligence that the Mueller team was apoplectic about how their work had been mischaracterized. But without having the report, there was nothing I could really say. And I was kind of being filleted alive by the right wing. They were representing all of these things about the Mueller report based on the summary and using it to attack me. And I felt like I had no way to defend myself because I didn't have the report to determine what in fact Mueller had said. And even on the day that Barr finally decided to release the report, he gave a news conference in which he further cemented the false impression of what Mueller had done. And as it turned out, that false representation, a quite blatant misrepresentation about so many things in Mueller's work, was really successful. It really cemented the narrative about what Mueller found and what he didn't find. And so that to me was among the most difficult personally, because I remember going through that period personally, feeling like I was just spinning in the wind and there was nothing I could do until the report came out. And by that time, the report came out, and I could point to all the reasons why what Barr had said was false. The narrative had really sunk in. And, I think if you look at Barr, I always viewed him during the last 4 years as the second most dangerous person in the administration. He really perverted the department in ways that had not been seen since Nixon. Made the Justice Department into a kind of a criminal defense firm for the president, used the department to go after the president's enemies, intervened in specific criminal cases. And maybe part of why I found it so offensive is I've been a prosecutor, I've been in that department, and I venerated the department. And here's a guy, this would have been unthinkable, intervenes in the case of Roger Stone, a man whose conviction was of lying to Congress and trying to intimidate other witnesses into lying to Congress to cover up for the president. And what does this attorney general do? Intervenes in the sentencing recommendation, which is never done by an attorney general, and certainly would never be done in a perjury case, let alone a perjury case involving the president. And then he personally intervenes in the case of Michael Flynn, another liar on behalf of the president, who pled guilty to lying to the FBI twice, and makes the case go away completely. And so, you know, I look at someone like that and I try to figure out, okay, what is the deal? Was it so important to him that he once again have a seat at the hands of power, that he once again be relevant, that he was willing to destroy his whole reputation and a good part of the department? And I think that there were, you know, two phenomena with Barr. The first is that under George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, he was serving a president with integrity. And you saw one side of Bill Barr. Now, there were glimpses into what really lay beneath the surface. And we didn't know this until much later, but he had worked in the Office of Legal Counsel prior to becoming Attorney General, and had been involved in the drafting of an opinion justifying the detention of a foreign leader, I think Manuel Noriega, and the United States' power to be able to detain a foreign leader or go ahead and seize a foreign leader. He had represented to the press what that opinion said, and misled the public about it because it wasn't released. And it wasn't released for decades later. And when it was released decades later, we got to see that he'd been lying to the public about what the opinion said. So I don't suspect that he was a different person, but I think he was surrounded by different people than he was with Trump. And so I think you got to see what his real character would allow when he was tethered to a man of low character. And I do think also that craving to be relevant again is true for Barr. I think it's true for Rudy Giuliani. I mean, you look at what happened to Rudy Giuliani. And I felt that way about Alan Dershowitz, honestly. I think the desire to be relevant again was so strong that it shows what people are willing to do to enjoy that again.
Yeah, I mean, to paraphrase Mary Trump, what Donald Trump brings out is the worst of people. You know, he doesn't change who they are, he brings out the worst of people. So pivoting to a question.
I think you could say that about people and about countries.
Yeah. So pivoting to something about, you know, some advice or some help you can give us, I'm going to turn this over to Mom Sense, who has beautiful plates in the back of her.
Oh, my Greek plates. Hi, Congressman Schiff. Thanks so much for joining us. I'll just tell you for background, I do a lot of campaigning here in Maine, which usually involves telephone calls into our CD2, which has gone Trump the last two cycles. So it's not as much fun as it used to be. So my question is really, I've been at DEF CON hair on fire about the insurrection and the threat to our democracy. Hearing you mention Bill Barr brought back that day was just devastating. But I find that a lot of my friends and acquaintances are, they just want to ignore it. And I think the stress and the fatigue from the last 6 years is a factor, and they just want normalcy. So my question is, how can we communicate the importance of getting to the bottom of the insurrection, the importance of truth and accountability in a way that encourages them to engage in helping our democracy and doesn't overwhelm? And I know that's an impossible task, but I wonder if you have any advice for us on how we can do that.
Well, it's a really important question. And for those of us on the Select Committee, it's something we think about all the time. What we are planning to do is, you know, within I think a couple months, 2 or 3 months from now, begin a series of public hearings, very high profile public hearings, to tell the story about January 6th. And importantly, as part of that story, that January 6th really isn't about a single day in America. It's about multiple lines of effort to overturn a presidential election and stop the peaceful transfer of power. And those multiple lines of effort involved trying to suborn local elections officials into ignoring the law or the facts, into trying to get state elected officials, elections officials, to find, in the case of Georgia, 11,780 votes that don't exist, to using the top level of the Justice Department to promulgate false claims of massive fraud and urge states to withhold the appointment of electors, to the most frivolous litigation, to, you know, ultimately a pressure campaign on the vice president, and then the use of force. And so we hope to use a series of public hearings to kind of elucidate all that went into trying to overturn the election, which began, in fact, before the election, by laying the predicate that, you can't trust absentee ballots, they'll be plagued with massive fraud, to any ballots counted after election day will be inherently illegitimate. You know, there was this whole laying of a foundation to overturn the results if it didn't go the right way. And most importantly in our work is to show that the danger is not dissipated, that the same lie that led to that violence on January 6th is being used around the country to usher in a new generation of Jim Crow laws, and to strip independent elections officials of their duties and give them over to partisans who will overturn the next election. We want to use this to make a series of recommendations and see if we can implement them to protect the country going forward. So that's what we're going to try to do. And I have to say, we're moving with, you know, incredible speed for Congress to try to get this done. We got it just before I got on. You may have seen the news. The Supreme Court denied the stay of the decision to release the records from the archives. I was still studying it when I jumped online with you all to see whether this is the end of the story or whether the Supreme Court will still need to decide if they're going to grant cert, and if they did grant cert, whether they would stay or whether we're going to get a bunch of documents tomorrow. So obviously I'm hoping it's the latter. But in terms of what you all can do, I think that the most important thing is to push back against these efforts to disenfranchise people and to attack the infrastructure of our elections. And so if people in Maine, who are the kind of local technocratic elections personnel, are being drummed out of their jobs or threatened, I think coming to their support so they don't leave those positions and then see those positions occupied by people who are such partisans that they will overturn the election upon the instructions of the former president. If the elections are in good shape where you are, there are a lot of ways to get involved online to help in other parts of the country that are really experiencing trouble now. I was talking to Joaquin Castro, my colleague from Texas, the other day, and he was telling me about the thousands and thousands, I think tens of thousands, of requests for absentee ballots because they're starting to be timely for the primary in Texas that are being refused based on the new law. So tens of thousands of voters already being potentially turned away. And those folks are going to need help navigating the new laws if we can't get the Senate to do the right thing. So I would say I would put that really at the top of the list of what we can do at the grassroots level.
So Adam, you have time for probably one or two more questions so you can get back to studying. So I just wanted to make sure that you were tracking the time.
Okay, thanks. I'll try to keep my answer shorter.
So there was a question that came from an anonymous commenter, Patrick, on a lighter note, to ask you about the time you audited Dershowitz's class in law school and what a joy that was and what you've learned.
You know, I audited that class for a while. And I'll tell you why I did is I had gone to see a debate. It's just crazy to think of it, between Alan Dershowitz and Rudy Giuliani, who had been on opposite sides of a series of cases called Prince of the City, which was involving corruption in the New York Police Department. And Giuliani had been on the prosecutorial side back then and Dershowitz on the defense side. And they were at the top of their game. It was like watching two legal gladiators go at each other. And it was fantastic. And so I went to audit his class. He taught a upper level seminar in criminal law. But I got bored because I wasn't learning anything about the law. It was just Dershowitz talking about himself. And you can only listen to that for so long. I kind of gave up and, I tell you, I had some wonderful professors and the most wonderful was Larry Tribe. And he and I have remained very close friends. And I served as a research assistant for him during law school. But I had other fabulous professors in law school who actually taught us the law. And, you know, they could have equally spent time talking about themselves, but didn't. And so that was my experience with Alan Dershowitz. I will tell you, I think I did talk about this in the book, but when Dershowitz first appeared during the trial, he walked down to the Senate floor with his dusty tome and he said, I'm going to transport you back to a warm night in Philadelphia and a cold winter's eve in, you know, Washington and bring you back to, you know, 18 whatever, or 17, whatever. And for an hour, he was like talking like a law professor. And even though I disagreed with his argument, it was entertaining. I was enjoying myself. I felt like I was back in law school. And we took a break and we went into our little preparation room, the house managers, they were bitching about Dershowitz and his arguments. And I'm like, I kind of enjoyed it. And they practically stoned me in there. And I said, I enjoyed listening to it. And then he just went completely off the deep end, which I have to say shocked me. You know, he started making this argument that, if you're the president of the United States and you believe your own reelection is in the public interest, then you can't be abusing the power of your office. It's unimpeachable. It was a breathtakingly irresponsible argument and constitutionally baseless. And then when he was criticized for it by me and others, he went even further and said the fact that Joe Biden was running for president made it even more appropriate to seek to smear him, because when he was just a former vice president, it wasn't that important. But now that he could be president, it made it even more okay, which was even more dangerously absurd. And even the Trump team, which wasn't characterized by all that much discretion, decided to bench him. And he not only said nothing the next day in trial, he wasn't even there. I was really shocked at what a poor advocate, in addition to everything else. I mean, why he would, first of all, it was kind of inexplicable to me why he would use his legal talent, whatever that was left, in the service of Donald Trump, but then to see how little was left was quite striking.
Amazing. So I think we have time for one more question, according to Patrick. There's a bunch of questions about where did you get that desk, but I'm going to ask something more related to the book. and this is from Louise B, who I don't think is here, but it's sort of a positive note to end on. And her question is, you know, she'd like to know how you retain your optimism, you know, in the face of this continuous, you know, relentless attacks on democracy at all levels of government. And that came through in the book. That was a very powerful portion of the book. It was just the relentless sense of optimism. How do you do it?
Well, I used to tell people that I take a lot of horse tranquilizers. but then I found somebody said to me, well, you know, that's actually a thing, so you probably shouldn't say that. To be serious about it, and I probably should spend more time emphasizing the heroes in the story. I often fixate on the Bill Barrs and the Devin Nuneses and the Trey Gowdies and the Donald Trumps, but I got to meet and know people like Marie Yovanovitch, who is this courageous woman who had served a country in dangerous places around the world, ends up being hounded out of her post, being told they can't protect her, and it's from her own president. It's from the president's own allies. And she comes back to DC, she's told, you need to get on the next plane out of Ukraine. And she comes back, we want her to testify, the president clearly doesn't, the State Department tells her not to. And you see what we're going through with the January 6th committee, with people the president doesn't want to testify. But Marie Yovanovitch is a patriot. She knows her lawful and her civic duty, and she comes and testifies. And her act of courage and patriotism, I think, was infectious. And it paved the way for others to come in. And Alexander Vindman's courage was infectious, and Bill Taylor and Robert Holmes and Fiona Hill and others. We know that courage is contagious. So is cowardice. We saw a lot of that. We continue to see a lot of the contagion of cowardice. But I firmly believe that, it's the Marie Yovanovitches and the Bill Taylors and the Alexander Vindmans and others that are going to get us through this. And that there are people of like-minded courage and patriotism all over the country, millions and millions of Americans who are devoted to our democracy and far outnumber those who are at the moment determined to tear it down. I think when you're in crisis, as we are, as a nation, it's hard to see how it ends. Sometimes it's hard to see if it ends, but it does end. This too shall pass. What we do in this moment, which is what has me staying at my post, what we do at this moment will determine how long it will take to pass and how much damage we'll be forced to suffer along the way. But let me just end with this thought, which is something that the speaker likes to say to all of us in Congress, but it's true of everyone outside of Congress as well. And that is, she likes to say, know your own power. We all have the power to influence our circumstances, and we can't all be Marie Yovanovitch and first through the breach showing the way, but within our own circle, however big or small that circle may be, whether it's our friends, our family, our neighbors, our precinct, our state, we can all have an impact. And there's nothing more debilitating than feeling powerless to affect your circumstances. And the reality is, none of us are powerless. We all have the ability to do our part. And we just need to figure out, each of us, what that is, and decide we're going to do the most that we can do. Don't try to take on everything. That way, paralysis lies. Just decide, okay, in the next year or so, here's what I'm going to do. Knowing it's not everything, but knowing it is something, and something important. And that's what keeps me going and keeps me optimistic.
Thank you so much. That was inspiring. And I can't thank you enough for coming and making our inaugural Balloon Juice book club such a success. I don't know how we follow up with this. I mean, we could do a Life on the Mississippi, but people would expect Mark Twain to come. So I just think this has been wonderful. We very much look forward to seeing you again on February 2nd. And somebody just posted that she's in Europe, and this is worth getting up at 2 a.m. for. So there you go.
Very nice.
You've got an international fan base here. So thank you again. This was just fabulous. And if everybody would unmute to give them a round of applause.
Thank you,
Congressman Schiff.
Thanks so
much.
That was great.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Congressman.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Patrick.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. That was pretty cool. That was very cool.
I'm waiting until everybody's off.
Wow.
Okay, so. Holy
shit. We're going to get that again.
First of all, could we could we applaud the job that Kurt did moderating and all the work that Water Girl has done?
Yes, yes.
It's all Water Girl.
You did great.
You guys,
these are live bloggers.
The questions that were submitted were fabulous. I mean, you know, they were great. And we, and I guess what we learned for the next time on February 2nd is, you know, we don't want to ask him specific questions. We want to sort of give him room to just run, which he did. I mean, Jesus Christ, I thought I was expecting us to get kind of, I don't know, you know, politician answers, which is what you usually get. But when I asked Casey's question, it was pretty clear that in his mind, it was like, you know, we're sitting around with a pitcher of beer, you know, at the Glendale bar tab. I'm my expectations are blown away.
And I love the way he name checked so many of the, how shall I say, villains in the piece. You know, he wasn't at all shy. He didn't weasel around and say some of my colleagues on the other side. He named names.
It's in the book.
Miscreants.